welcome to another exciting show of Extra Features Interviews. Today I have a fabulous guest with a fast film title name that you've heard in ages. Brides of Satan, the director Joe Bizzaro is here, and I hope he lives up to its name. Welcome.
Joe Bizzaro! Hey, see? Man, thanks for having me. I'm feeling pretty weird already tonight.
So let's start. Where did this title come from? Like, this is a great title for a movie.
I love that question. And, when we wrote this movie, we had a lot of different ideas about what it was about. And actually, what it originally was is nothing as to what it turned into. But we knew that the title was sensational. And it had actually been a bit of advice that we had gotten from a friend who we'd go to horror conventions with. This guy named Dave Litz. And he was like, it just seemed like this, you know, kind of thing you should already know about. But the way he said it, he's like, it's best to have a movie with that starts with A, B, or C, because it's the first thing that you're going to see on the shelf. And the first thing that you're going to see when the distributor is shopping for it at a festival. So that was a big part of the decision, actually. We said, let's make a movie that starts with A, B, or C. And my co-partner, co-creator, DP Noel Maitland, said Brides of Satan. And originally, the movie was about like this. It was about something completely different. But we decided to keep the title.
What happened to the other film? Like, are you still going to use it later, or it's not, never to come back?
No, it's probably gone. I believe that there are elements of the other film that made it into this movie, but it was very strange because our other script had very glaring similarities to the movie Mandy with Nicolas Cage. And we had written all that, our stuff way before Mandy had come out. And when we saw Mandy, we were like, holy shit, this was like kind of what we were trying to do. And it really kind of blew our minds. And so what actually really happened in Brides of Satan when we shot the film was we didn't have any money. We didn't have an investor. We didn't have anyone backing us. So it was just kind of pocket change that I had saved up. We did the movie in 8 days. So we would shoot like 1 or 2 days a year, and I would save up a little bit of money and we would try to reassemble the thing again. Well, after we'd shot, I think our third or fourth day, it was basically like, you know, a third or half of the script. We were kind of looking at the dailies and we weren't really sure about how we felt about it. And we decided to kind of like completely get rid of the script altogether, which was a really bizarre and strange kind of bold move. We were just like, let's go and shoot this next thing and see how it feels. And we started molding the story around the last scene that we had shot. And we would just become very organic and flowing about how we would let characters or ideas enter the space. And we would write and rewrite and write and rewrite. And we did a lot of writing and rewriting. It would always constantly morph, but this film in theory was written kind of, the script was written as we would shoot scenes. So we would write the script as we would go.
Okay. I got two questions. The first one is, so how many years did it take you to shoot this film then?
5.
It doesn't feel like that at all. Like it's good editing.
It's pretty amazing, some of the stuff we had some challenges too. I mean, and there's a lot of funny things that I like to, Easter eggs that I like to admit. There's an actress in the beginning who, Rachel Rampage, who's Canadian, a fellow Canadian adult actress. And she was a friend of Joanna Angel and was just happened to be in LA and did the part of Zoe Knox, I think is the name of the character. And so we shot our very first day, and then we came back like a year later to pick up the very next scene, maybe a year and a half later. And Rachel wasn't available. She was back in Canada. And so we ended up finding someone on Facebook or Craigslist or somewhere who mimicked her, you know, put on the wig, and we like literally have a stand-in in the first like 15 minutes of the movie, and no one ever points it out. I mean, I think I've been called on it like twice, but it's amazing the power of movie editing and movie magic and what you can kind of do. And there's like, it's a kind of like a sleight of hand. And if you go back and watch the film now, you'll see it. But, and also in that scene, our main character, Alice McMunn, her mohawk is like a whole nother color altogether. And I remember when we called her, she was like, I'm not going to cut my hair. I'm not going to change my hair. And she was freaking out. We're talking about getting a wig and all of this drama. And it ended up turning out that we just like pulled the hood over her head as she walks out the door. So as you see them walk out the door after they kidnap the couple, it's like 2 years later in real time. But it's, you know, 10 seconds in movie time.
I don't even know how you even thought to do this over 5 years. I understand you have no money, but usually people cobble something together within 30 days or a year. But that's dedication. I got to give you full props for 5 years and going right back to where you were and picking up.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it was definitely a labor of love, and a lot of times you want to quit and you want to give up, but I like to finish things, so we finished it. And it's not the perfect movie. There's a lot of things that aren't what we wanted and didn't turn out the way we would have liked, and we wish we had more time and this and that and every other excuse. But you know, for what it is, we think we made a pretty entertaining film.
Okay, now we can get into the film and we can go off tangent. Don't worry, I'm all good either way. Good. The strip club at the beginning, is it a real strip club or did you change something to make it a strip club?
So that the first scene that you see, we shot, I think, about 15 pages on our very first day. So like our first day of photography, we shot a whole bunch of scenes. We shot that Vincent Price scene there. We shot the whole strip club scene, the abduction, all of that. It was a club called the Dragonfly, and it was in Hollywood, on Hollywood or Sunset, somewhere over there. And we had a friend named Mike Ansbach who knew the owner, and we ended up getting it. And it still cost us quite a bit of money for our budget. I mean, it's half of our budget. That was a $5,000 day for everything. And it was, I think, $2,500 just to rent that place. So it was half of our money. But they had just changed it over, and there was like this room that had this whole David Lynch vibe with like checkered floors and red curtains. And then there was like a room with booths, and we had like a backstage room. We were doing like some BTS, and it was just the perfect space. I mean, we just kind of got lucky and walked in there, and then we just used it as much as we could, as much as possible. Even the scene where you see the couple, you know, when she says she's going to take him out for a surprise, she brings him a little birthday cake. We just shot that like in a corner of that club too, and just kind of made it fall into black. I mean, like we shot tons of stuff right there in that space in that one day. So that's what that was, the Dragonfly.
I got to say, the hairstyles in this film are incredible. I want to say, where did you find your hairstylist? Because I keep making notes about hairstyling. I loved it.
You know, we there's no hair and makeup on our sets, unfortunately. I think there was a day or two where we had our friend Alexa, who was a sweetheart, help out. But, you know, everyone kind of in our world kind of comes camera ready or does that themselves. I was fortunate enough to cast really beautiful, lovely, talented women who just look gorgeous and have a very high sense of fashion and style.
Okay, so all the costume design is their costumes, and they brought their own?
For the most part, we supplied certain things and bought some duplicate copies of things. In Mindy's case, her wardrobe changes a lot. And Mindy Robinson, who plays Mary, her wardrobe changes through the whole movie. So we supplied a lot of that, or duplicated that from a thrift store. But for the most part, a lot of these people are playing, you know, some kind of role of what they look like in real life or things that they have in their closet already. We didn't really have a wardrobe department. We really didn't have a hair and makeup artist. we really didn't have a dedicated, we didn't have a lot of dedicated key roles. I mean, this was five or six people running around kind of all hands on deck most of the time. So we didn't have most of that.
Okay. You have some black and white shots. Now, was that because you needed to do that, was going back to shoot it now, I'm asking, or was that always planned to have?
I'm thinking of the two areas in the movie where it goes black and white. And the one that I can recall is when Lenny Lester, the old man in the junkyard, he's telling a story about, you know, how they kidnapped his dog. And that was a stylistic thing to kind of do a flashback and to kind of make it look like it was, you know, and I felt like it, that worked really well. And then the other time that I can remember using it was in the nightmare with the little kid and the ring and the maggots. And
that's where Michael, I was going.
Michael Reed. You know, that's a good question. The answer's funny. This is like another Easter egg. We did a scene with, he was crying. We tried to give him these eye drops that made him cry black tears. And we wanted him to cry black tears. And then I think my co-partner, my DP was like, let's give him Hershey syrup, you know? And we put Hershey syrup in his mouth, and the consistency wasn't just the same. And it just didn't look the same. And when you looked at it on color, it drove me absolutely crazy. I just hated it. And so that was actually a conversation and a fight to change that scene to black and white. But that was a decision because I hated how we approached the makeup, because once again, there really wasn't a special effects artist or a makeup artist there on that day.
I love it. I presume the host was going back to the Elvira thing or somebody other hosts I probably don't know about.
If you're talking about the host at the very beginning who kind of tells the story. So that gentleman's name is Rick Gallagher, and he's really great. He's a great, just great guy all around, great character actor. And when I met him, I met him at a Monster Palooza in Burbank or something like that. And he used to play this character called like Grim the Undertaker or something. I can't remember. I can't put my finger on it, but he would dress up like a, you know, kind of like an Undertaker, all white, big hat and very theatrical, and would give these like Hollywood ghost tours and would go all around Hollywood and was like, he would go to conventions, super animated guy. And then I ended up like just talking to him online, and he ended up just being this super sweet, kind of quiet, shy, more humble, grateful guy. It was very interesting, but just a great actor. So he actually plays, he's in the movie twice. If you didn't notice, he's also the guy at the end who runs the freak show.
Oh, okay.
So we literally used him twice in the film, which I thought was fun, as two characters. But yeah, we were just kind of going for a Vincent Price kind of vibe. And that role, originally at one point, we were talking to Corey Feldman, who was going to play it. And we were trying to we almost got a hold of John Waters, who we were trying to have do it. And so it went through a lot of different maybes of really fun people before we ended up with who we did. But once again, we were really happy with it. Fake mustache and all.
I do have a note on the look of the DJ. Did you do any work to the DJ's teeth or anything? Or he just, that's the way he really looks.
Once again, man, I just love to find these really great characters who just look really cool in real life and have great fashion and are just interesting people. And I mean, you could probably name almost any character from this movie, and I can tell you a little background story about them. That dude's name is Lightning Woodcock.
And I love it.
Lightning Woodcock, and he is an L.A. like icon. He plays blues and rock and roll, and he does a lot of residencies. I think Harvard and Stone. He does a residency at Harvard and Stone in Hollywood. But yeah, we got lucky and found just a lot of really great people and tried to just make really colorful casting choices. I love that shot where the camera goes real close on his face, and it's almost like you're watching a Ren and Stimpy cartoon. But he was awesome.
Okay, you yourself are a musician, from what I've understood in our correspondence.
I am, actually. I don't really typically talk about it or advertise it much through my kind of brand as Joe Bizarro and Joe Bizarro Studios. But yeah, I've been playing music my whole life. I play a little bit of everything, guitar, bass, drums, piano. I've been teaching myself Pro Tools and doing all kinds of audio recording and making beats. And I love it. I can't get enough. So yeah, I love music.
So my question is, when you were designing this film and being a musician, how hard was it to pick the tracks you wanted then, since you, or did you know everybody you were going to pick anyway?
Well, there's really a lot of music in this movie, And my co-director once, or my co-partner Noel says, you know, this movie's a fever dream. Like, it's just almost like a long music video. So there's a lot of people to kind of thank and who were helpful in that. I had a friend named Matt Rapoli, and he did a lot of some really cool score work on it. And I did as well. I did a lot of the sound design myself. I didn't credit myself. I made up a weird alias in the credits. But I think Charney Cherkowski is my name. But I did quite a bit of the music. Matt Rapoli did some of the music, and the real star, the superstar, is this cat from Australia named the Jimmy C, Jamie Coghill, who is like a career musician. He's a drummer, but he plays every instrument, does all the recording, does all the mastering, writes these killer songs. He did an entire soundtrack on Spotify of, I think, 21 or 18 or 21 original songs. So if you were to type in Bride of Satan on Spotify or iTunes, you could listen to the soundtrack for the movie. So there's a lot of music in the movie, and I got lucky with great people who provided it.
I got to say, for an independent, low-budget film, I loved your lighting. So where does your lighting background come from?
A lot of that was my director of photography, Noel Maitland. I think he does a lot of really beautiful stuff. Some of our stuff is verite, obviously, outside where we don't have a lot going on there, but inside it's usually like three or four lights that he's got going, and just really, I love the lighting in the film as well. I think for a low budget movie, the lighting in the film really makes this movie look a lot higher budget than it is. And so that's really all props to my DP and cinematographer, Noel Maitland.
But I think you guys get a lot out of nothing here. I mean, even the scenes when your lead is walking down the street or getting into a car. I mean, I find your shooting set, you don't waste your shots, is what I'm trying to say. Maybe that's your tight editing. Maybe you did have some stuff you didn't like. But I always find when you're shooting, it serves a purpose. And I find with a lot of indies, I don't see that. So is that just you personally, or is that just your editing style?
I really appreciate that compliment. And, I wish that I could say it's the best editing that I have, I guess, because in a lot of these cases, I don't have extra shots. I don't have the coverage that I want. I don't have another take. I'm constantly battling time or the clock or the sun. So, I think in a lot of these places, I wish that things were tighter and better and had more. But you just kind of do your best with what you have. And I think that's the case here. We did our best.
I really felt I wish you had a little bit more coverage. There's only one shot. When you have the big sacrifice shot, you know the one I'm talking about.
We can do spoilers if you want.
Okay. Well, I'll try not to. You can spoil it with your movie, but you know what I'm talking about. I felt bad for you in your coverage on that shot because I felt you were rushed shooting it. Because I figured you didn't have enough time. I'm like, I know he what shot you were looking for, and I know what you were trying to do, and I'm like, he's running out of time. You could just feel the hurriedness of everybody, and I felt bad for you, because I'm enjoying the film, and I'm like, slow this down. You got to slow this down, but I know you can't.
You're 100% right, and that is what happened. We were in, the 13th, 14th hour at a paid space, which, once again, we like – just made as many cool looks that we could in, and we got away with a lot. It was a really great location, actually. But that guy who plays the demon, his name's Draco Rex, and then his makeup artist was Thomas Suprenant, and Lisa Hansel was also there that day. Also, shout out to Liz, who came and helped out. But anyways, man, he was. They were in makeup all day long waiting to do that scene while we were doing all the kills. I mean, we shot so much stuff again that day, and just a small amount of time, we just crammed it in. We tried to do special effects, and a lot of the stuff didn't turn out. Like, head explosions that didn't work. We were just like, okay, that's, I guess, what we get. It's unfortunate, but we just kind of kept shooting. And yeah, I wish we could see more of the demon. I wish there was more interaction. He was also blind, which led to some challenges, the actor not being able to see what he's doing very much, led to some challenges. But we all wish there could have been more, a bigger explosion, more gore, more guts. But we were just running out, you know, and in the 15th hour, we had to mop all that shit up, you know, all the goo that we threw on the walls and on each other. And it's just like, you get burned out. And unfortunately, that's how the ending, it's not terrible, but it's not what I wanted.
I don't want you to knock yourself out. I want everybody to know, this is a great, fun film. Like, you're an indie. I give you guys slack everywhere. And I have to, because I know you don't have the money. And I know you only have so much time in some locations, and I get that. Now, I got to say, most of your film works for me because it's great casting. Is there anybody you didn't get that you wanted? I mean, Corey Feldman, I don't know if it would have worked after watching this.
That's true. And, you know, like I said, it's just like the script that we kind of abandoned and recreated. There's just a lot of mutation in this project. And when you work on something for that many years, it goes through so many cycles and ups and downs and ins and outs and possible investors and possible talent. And I mean, there were so many people. We almost worked with Kane Hodder for a moment. We almost worked with Michael J. White for a moment. You know, they were just like, these were conversations, but even just that, I had talked to Dr. Demento for a moment. You know, just trying to get wow. some really, really, yeah, he's one of my childhood, you know, favorites, you know. So we really tried to get just really cool, interesting casting. But, you know, you don't always get your way. But as it goes through multiple years, it mutated. We had a lot of different people in mind for a lot of different parts. But usually what you get isn't what you wanted. You have to just be okay with that sometimes.
Okay, why are credits so late starting in the movie? They're 60 minutes in.
It's called the cold open.
Okay.
No. I mean, there really is a reason for that. And really, I guess we could have recut that or rethought that or figured that out in another way. But that 15 minutes that you see at the beginning before you see like that kind of shorter credit bed, kind of little music video credit bed. That was all the first day of shooting. So that was all what we had done in one day, and the reason why it is edited like that is because we had done that day, cut together that 15 minutes and kind of then showed that to people, showed that off, helped use that as a tool to build interest, to have more people be involved or to act or to come help out and volunteer their services at their time. And so that's why that scene is like that. We just never changed it back. We just kind of liked the way it looked. And it really is a bit of a, for as much as I love pacing, I will admit that it's not the best. It's not the greatest pace, but it's true. But it is kind of just one of those things that we were like, well, this is the way it is and it's how it fits into the puzzle of this whole thing. And I like that it doesn't fit the complete, you know, ABC structure of what an editing movie is supposed to look like or, you know, certain act structure. Like, this movie doesn't do that. It just kind of does whatever it wants, jumps all over the place. So, I don't know.
The red mask, was it ever going to be a different color or was it always red for Satan and blood?
We're talking about the goat masks that yes. the naked
that's
girls
exactly
wear?
What I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think we had got one of those masks from the party store and just painted them this like fire engine red. I love those scenes. Every time we see those girls, I love the way those scenes look. And I think at the end they wear them too, at the final, during the final sacrifice, the three girls wear that. That's one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie, where they kill the virgin and they're like drinking the blood, making out. I just love that shot. It's one of my favorites.
Influence for this film. I mean, are we looking at like Demon Warp and some old 80s over the counter VHS, or we're going a little bit deeper?
I would say the influence is all over the place. You know, you kind of start off with influence and then it once again mutates. But what we really wanted to go for was just like, you know, that kind of 70s vibe. I shouldn't even say that 70s vibe. What we really tried to go for is kind of a timeless vibe. We never put cell phones in the movies. I never like to see any kind of technology that I can avoid. Cars, cell phones, watches. If there's anything that I can disclude from the shot to make it feel like a different time, that's kind of what I really try to go for. You know, I forgot the question. Sorry.
It's all good. I like your answer better than my question, so we'll just go with it. It's fine. How was working in CGI?
Terrible.
Okay.
We don't have a whole lot of CGI in this, but I will say most of the CGI that we have are additional kind of like little blood spatters and stuff like that to kind of cover up some of the shots. But all of that stuff is done with the bare minimum kind of After Effects kit. That probably some 20-year-old plugins. Like we really didn't have a CGI artist. Once again, it was all that stuff was done by me and my co-editor. My DP and I edited the film. So a lot of times those things were used to, I don't want to say cover up shots, sometimes cover up things or sometimes just enhance things. And I was really happy with the way that just some subtle, you know, blood texture on the screen can kind of hide some little mistakes in the indie frame.
I had a question. At one point, we're right near the end of the film. Is it a junkyard or a trailer park? Because I really wasn't sure.
It's a junkyard, and it's a real-life junkyard. And that was always one of my dreams, was to shoot in a junkyard, actually. And when I was a little kid, I must have been like, you know, 5 or 6 years old. And there was this like place off the highway in Cleveland off like 480. And it was called, if anyone ever hears this and can confirm this, but it was called like the Atomic Playground. And there was this weird neon sign off of the freeway said the Atomic Playground. And I believe it was a junkyard, but I always had a fascination with junkyards in movies. I love that movie Street Trash too, where they have a lot of junkyard scenes. But always wanted to shoot in the junkyard, and we just got lucky. And we had a friend named Will Wolf, who was like a kind of a co-producer, associate producer, and he knew this guy named like Junkyard Bob or Junkyard Dan or something. You should look at my phone for it. I wish I could remember his name. But he lived there. He lived there in the junkyard. He was all about his, you know, America. And he was great. But we shot in the junkyard for 2 days and just kind of like went into old dead RVs that were there on the lot and just kind of like cleaned out the cobwebs and broken glass and tried to pretend like it was ours, you know. And I remember at one point, like Mindy Robinson went and like, you know, found another weird broken down RV and made it in her little trailer, her green room, you know, all covered in bugs and dirt and dust. It was funny, but yeah, I always wanted to shoot in a junkyard, and we shot that in a real junkyard, Riverside, California.
Oh, there you go. Now I know.
Okay. And hold on. I got to say the one other thing that was hilarious about it was getting that location was so important to me. And I love that we got it. That we all of the cast and crew stayed together in an Airbnb for 2 days. And we were like sleeping on the floor and, in bunks and sleeping bags. And man, it was just like, it was definitely like down and dirty, as low budget as it comes. And everyone was just cool as shit. I remember we were just eating like late night cheeseburgers from McDonald's or something, and everybody was just having such a good time, happy to be there. It was such a great moment.
Isn't that the true independent spirit, though? Like, you're making indie films. I mean, you're pouring your heart and soul into this. I mean, you only have so much money, and everybody in this knows you're not going to be a millionaire at the end of it.
Yeah, it really was very humbling and just one of my happiest moments I could probably recall working on any kind of TV or show or movie. Just that moment right there, you know?
How much fun was doing an 80s training montage?
It would have been more fun if we had a little more time. There are a lot more shots in the shot list, let's put it that way. And the music, I think, was pretty great. And we threw some old film strip shit on there and made it look kind of clunky and junky. But I wish that there was more. She was supposed to run with the dog and train with Rufus and
do a lot.
Yeah, there was a lot of really fun stuff in there, you know. But we just kind of, once again, we only had so much time. And it's best laid plans, you know. You learn that all these things that you have written down, you don't usually get them all. And you got to sacrifice your babies, you know. You got to kill your babies.
How did you enjoy working with blood?
Like, you know, fake blood?
Yes.
Oh, man, it's always fun covering people in blood and getting covered in blood and, you know, all that stuff. And there is a scene where Mary rips one of the guy's eyeballs out under the bridge, the Savage Six. And we had made like a fake eyeball, and she squeezes it and she says some tagline. But our DP, as he was handheld on that, got just splat right in the face. I'll never forget. He was right in the glasses, right all over his face, holding the camera. And he had made the gag, so it was especially funny that it blew up on him.
There you go. She has a cane. Where did the cane come from?
So the cane actually comes from the old man that saves her, Lenny Lester.
No, I know originally where she gets it from, but...
Oh, like, where did the idea of that come from?
No, where did the cane come from? Did you buy it? Was it somebody's...
I believe we bought it on the internet. Somehow, somewhere in there, we had the idea to give him this cane that he walks around with that eventually he'll expose that there's a knife in there, and he fucks the bad guys up. And sometimes it's hard to see it in the shot because it's in the wide shot. We didn't really have time for coverage. It would have been cool to see it come out of there. But, you know, he pulls it out of nowhere, and all of a sudden the old man is ready to fight. And that's pretty funny to see an old guy kick a bunch of young dudes' butt.
Okay, there's a location under a bridge near the railroad tracks. Where is that? They really liked it.
That's downtown Los Angeles. A lot of downtown LA just looks like that. Oh, and you know, cool. we were definitely were dodging syringes and broken glass and a lot of hazardous things that day and shooting that stuff. Yeah.
Ouch. Okay, my last question about the film. The look of the end creature is just awesome. How much time did you spend on that?
Like I said, we were shooting the movie in different locations and areas of the set that day because it was a pretty big place. And on like the third floor, we had Draco Rex and Thomas Reprennet and Lisa Hansel and Liz. And they spent the whole day on that guy. I mean, he must have been making for 6, 7, or 8 hours. And then we shot with him for maybe like 30 or 40 minutes, if that.
Ouch. Yeah, time. I know. It's just the way it works. Okay, it's time for some fun questions for you.
Cool.
Oh, before I go to the fun questions, where everybody can find your film, they can buy it somewhere in Canada. I know that.
Yeah, the easiest way to probably watch it is tubitv.com for free, which is great. And you can get it on Amazon if you wanted to buy the physical media. It's available on Amazon, Best Buy, Walmart, all of those kind of different outlets, the .coms of those.
Hold on. Walmart carries Pride of Satan?
Believe it or not, yeah. But they don't carry it in the store, I believe.
No, of course not.
I believe that we have made it onto the shelf. And I was always concerned about that when we named this film. In fact, the other name was Brides of Mayhem. At one point, we were like, can we get away with it? And they were like, yeah, you can. So I was surprised.
Okay, your fun question time. And then you get to leave. You're very close. Your favorite film of all times, please?
My favorite film of all times. Well, you know, it's not a horror film, to be honest, but I, so maybe I can try to think of a horror one too. But my favorite movie of all time is The Jerk with Steve Martin.
Oh, great film.
Yeah,
now, my second question for you, I wanted to give you some love for your independent friends because I know you have many of them. So you're only going to single out one just because I'm making you single out one, even though you could name 10. What film would you recommend that somebody had seen that they've never heard of that's indie?
Oh, man. Wow. That's really putting me on the spot.
I am going to put you on the spot, but I did say you could name 10, but I don't know if I only make you name one.
I mean, even that's hard. Even that's tough to do. Let me think about this. One movie that people should see. You know, I'm just going to go ahead and say that I think people really should look out for this Paul Ragsdale dude and his partner. I think her name's Angie. Their next movie, I think, is called Murder Size. And
it is.
I can see what he's doing, and I can see all the work that he's putting into it. He's really spending a lot of time on his like campaigns, photographs, and we try to do all that stuff too. But I can tell he's doing it better. I think he's like really someone to keep an eye on, I guess. I wish that I could tell you another great horror film or film that I've seen lately, but I'm just drawing a blank, man.
All good. Your last one's really easy. Your favorite dinner.
Oh, man. You know, a little surf and turf action. Never heard
Perfect.
Of anybody.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you, man. Appreciate having me.